Had the full long intro in a long time. This is Pure Decking for June 28th, 2012, because, well, today's the most important day of history. There you go. Okay, now.
Well, it really is. You know, actually, today a landmark, you know, decision was made. I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, socialized medicine for all.
Yeah, that's not actually what it is, but.
No, it's not.
I know.
I'm almost wondering if it might have been better if they did go to... Fuck it. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morse. Tonight I have Analog and a Dying Are You. So...
let's see. Tonight's show is going to be hijacked by me because I'm on pills.
I don't even need to ask what you guys are drinking. We all know. So just to wrap up from last week, I mentioned I was going to go do the zombie run, and I noticed my level's kind of quiet. There we go. Adjust that. I fixed the sound card in the broadcast box, so I'm able to pipe in the better quality off my mixer as opposed to going through Skype. And I got used to Skype auto-leveling everything for me, so now I'm sitting here watching the knobs and all that good shit. Anyways, so to follow up from last week, yes, I did, in fact, go do the zombie run. Now, I should point out, I was expecting a 5K marathon-type run, like, you know, flat, with some people in costume. No, this was a semi-military obstacle course. So, I was not anywhere near as ready as I thought I was, so it ended badly with me getting tackled and rolling down a hill. Anyway, so I did not survive. I, in fact, was turned into a zombie, but I haven't noticed anything different. RU, on the other hand, appears to have gotten the brunt of it.
You know, I got it by proxy, man. Thanks for that.
So,
and congratulations to Laser, who made it survival.
He did. Laser, he had a much he did a much better time than I did, and actually had a flag lift at the run. So congrats, Laser Wolf. Yeah, good job, dude. So, you know, it's always fun going back and checking, you know, some of the posts and figuring, oh, crap, no wonder that obstacle was so hard. It was electrified. Turns out the last fence you had to roll under was electrified. I didn't know that at the time when I just dove under the damn thing. So, yeah.
How often do they hold these zombie runs?
There's like six a year.
Man, we should try and do one when I'm down there for 2013.
We might look into it. If we're going to do it, I need to find a couple of parks and just go romp through the woods for 10 kilometers every other day. Because I don't know how else to get ready for that kind of a run. It was brutal, man.
I'll tell you the best way to get ready for that run. Go down to the local unemployment office, grab a heap of money, and yo, free money, bitches, whoever can catch me.
Nice.
Very
you'll
nice.
Be doing some urban parkour right there, man, as the hordes of broke-ass Americans chase you for free bucks.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah, I guess I could go over the run a little bit if you guys want. I've kind of explained it to everybody off air, but just for the show here, just to kind of go into it, it was a 5K run, but it wasn't flat. It was through a nature trail. The trail was mostly sand and gravel, and it was very, very hilly. So, and not hilly like, you know, oh, you know, a little bit of an incline. No, I mean, it was like half the time you needed your hands to help you climb up some of these hills. So, you know, the first thing they have you do is jump a, you know, 5-foot embankment into a pond. So it's just like, okay. Shit. Then they have to jump into a second pond, then run in a creek for, jeez. I don't know how long I was in the creek, but it was long enough to make you tired. Gravel crawl, you actually had to get down on gravel and crawl. Would have been nice if I'd known to wear long pants.
So break out the tactical 9/11 pants for the next run.
Oh, shit, dude. If I do it again, I'm going to get some waterproof, probably combat boots, and some of the lightweight. I can't think what those pants are called. There's a waterproof lightweight pant that you tuck into the boot and water.
Depends.
Well, it's some sort of military surplus, but it was designed so you could move around in the summer and not get overheated, but it would still mostly stay dry.
Yeah. So, would you say you need a camel pack for it, or is there a sufficient enough water along the way?
They had three stops for water about, you know, every 2 kilometers, give or take. So there were a couple of stops for water, and they had to have them out because it was hot enough. But some the obstacles actually weren't so bad. But instead of mostly being just a straight, you know, marathon run, it actually turned more into jog or, you know, in the later parts, walk or even crawl a little bit between the obstacles and the zombie hordes. Sprint through the zombie hordes, and there had to be 200 to 300 people in costume out there on that trail. This thing was huge, man. And my number was 13,000, if that says anything. So,
wow, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it was quite large. And so you end up sprinting or doing an obstacle, and the obstacles, you know, were actually the easiest part of the course. So, you know,
so the people dressed as zombies, were they making like a real effort to at you?
Well, some of them. Some of them would chase you, and it seemed like latter half of the trail they were more aggressive than at the beginning. Maybe you just noticed it more. I'm not really sure, but they had some who would just kind of stand there and lunge at you, you know, shambler style. And then you had others that, you know, full on 28 days later, chase you down and tackle you. So,
which is the scarier version?
I don't know. Mixing it up was pretty good because you didn't know which ones were going to let you, you know, just kind of sprint by them and which ones were going to, you know, chase you. So,
yeah, fair enough.
It got to be, it was an experience. It was quite a thing to do. And I do want to do it again. But I'm going to have to get into much better shape. I'm sitting there within the first mile or near the end of the first mile. I'm sitting there going, I'm a fat computer nerd. What the hell was I thinking? So
for the next race, I get to train him.
You know, that might not be a bad idea. So, of course, that means you're going with me and you're training too. But that's not the point. So,
of course.
So, anyways, I know I've mentioned it before. I am working on replacing the broadcast box, so the stream is going to be up and down as I work on it. That happened a little bit last week. That's going to continue because I've got some stuff we're playing with, and I'm going to have to write some code to make it all work, which actually I got digging through the source code that I wanted to mess with. It does not look bad. I think I could probably get something going for us to start testing this weekend. So, that'll be fun. And if we get that working, that will open up a lot of possibilities for making it easier to get more people involved in running the station. So it's not just me. So anyways, though, let me adjust something here. Might be a little bit of mic noise. Sorry about that. So, all right, into the current events. First story up is from The Verge, but this is all over the fucking place. A research team has shown that it can crack security devices used by government agencies and enterprise companies like the RSA Secure ID 800, which is the one they actually cracked, to protect their data. The researchers refined a method developed in 2006 by Swiss cryptographer Daniel Bleckenbracher for retrieving the cryptographic keys used in RSA signature validation. In a paper detailing the refinement, The team says it was able to reduce the time needed to discover the secret keys to just 13 minutes. The method also works, albeit slightly less effectively, on other secure token devices like the Siemens OS card, Siemens card OS, say that right might help, 21 minutes, the SafeNet iKey, 2032, 88 minutes, and the Gemalto CyberFlex, 92 minutes. The method allows for the use of a command form or command from PKCS number 11 API that is implemented in such a way that it offers a padding oracle, a server-side channel which reports on whether a decryption has succeeded. When the oracle, in this case the server, responds, it leaks data that may allow attackers to decrypt messages without knowing the encryption key. Commonly referred to as the million message attack, it usually requires an average of 215,000 queries to reveal a 10,024-bit key. 1,024-bit key. Too many numbers. It's been a long day. The refined method suggested in the document improves the algorithm and only requires an average of 9,400 calls to reveal the same key. They accomplish this by using a theorem that allows not only multiplication but also division to be used in manipulating the PKCS version 1.5 ciphertext to learn about the plaintext. The paper said that the attacks are efficient enough to be practical. Now, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to do the RSA story, because RSA called bullshit on the researchers. But then a bunch of independent researchers called bullshit on RSA calling bullshit. So it's real, but you notice they have to observe a lot of traffic between the token and the server to make it work. So, again, don't lose your fucking token, and you still want to use a decent password. So does that mean, oh, your RSA tokens are worthless? No. No, it doesn't. It just means you need to be careful with them.
Fair enough.
So, you know, I mean, it's just like the breach they had. Was it last year or was it 2 years ago now?
Dude, that makes hacking sound so fucking boring, dude. You know, it doesn't sound Hollywood exciting.
Oh, I'm going to pick apart Hollywood when we get to the Digital Dojo. I don't know if you scrolled down and looked at that or not. But yeah, hacking's only exciting at the very end. When you get into the box, up until there, it's a whole lot of tedium. So, you know. But, all right, well. Like,
yeah, I've nothing on that one, man.
Yeah, it's RSA tokens are getting popped. Don't lose your token. Don't let somebody see the serial number off the back of the thing. And keep your password secret. I mean, you know, still at the end of the day, you're depending on a password. And yes, the tokens can be cracked, but it sounds like they have to have it away from you for a length of time, so don't lose it. You know, I mean, common sense still applies to these things. A lot of people treat these RSA tokens like, okay, my password can be 12345. No, it can't. So, anyways, this next one's funny. It's from Yahoo, but a couple of other people covered it as well. Orbitz Worldwide Incorporated has found that people who use Apple Mac computers spend as much as 30% more on a night in on hotels. So the online travel agency is starting to show them different and sometimes costlier travel options than Windows visitors see. The Orbitz effect, which in its early stages demonstrates how tracking people's online activities can use even seemingly innocuous information, in this case the fact that customers are visiting Orbitz from a Mac, to start predicting their tastes and spending habits. Orbitz executives confirmed that the company is experimenting with showing different hotels offers to Mac and PC visitors, but said the company isn't showing the same room to different users at different prices. So they're not manipulating the prices. It's not like they're going to charge you more for using a Mac. They're just going to show you the more expensive ones if you're using a Mac.
They also
pointed out that users can opt to rank results by price. Orbitz found Mac users on average spend $20 to $30 more in a night than hotels and their PC counterparts, a significant margin given the site's average night hotel booking is around $100. Chief scientist Wai Gin Yee said, Mac users are 40% more likely to book a 4 or 5 star hotel than PC users, Mr. Yee said. And when Mac and PC users book the same hotel, Mac users tend to stay in more expensive rooms. We had the intuition, and we were able to confirm based on the data, Orbit's chief technology officer, Roger Liu, said. So, yeah, Orbitz is going to start showing Mac users the more expensive options.
But everyone knows if you have a Mac, you've got more money anyway, or you're in deeper debt.
I don't know. Analog, what do you think?
No. I disagree on all levels.
I don't necessarily disagree with the idea of profiling based on what computer you're coming from. It does make me wonder, though, should I be using one of those user agent strings so that I get shown the best, you know, pricing on everything? It's like, what do they show you if, you know, if you show up using, like, you know, Linux or...
an Alley. An Alley, because they know you can't afford real software.
Or, like, a BlackBerry. If you show up on a BlackBerry browser, do they just, like, laugh at you? I mean...
They send you down to the sleazy motel.
Well, sir, I think you want the
where you got to work for your night.
Well, and also they said you can sort it by price anyway, so it doesn't necessarily. But I you know, you wonder, what if other sites, like what if Amazon started going, okay, this person's showing up, their browser's a Mac, let's show them the more expensive, you know, toilet paper, whatever it is they're looking for on Amazon. So, you know, and maybe they don't quite make it clear. It's one thing if they do that and they say they're doing that, and then give you an option to go in and change the filtering so you can do whatever you want. But what if they don't say they're doing it? What if they just kind of do it?
What? Okay. So just – it was out of sheer curiosity. Yes, Amazon sells toilet paper. What the – never mind.
I don't know. It was the first thing that came to my mind as an example of something you would look for.
The funny thing is that they actually sell it on Amazon. But
they sell everything on Amazon.
Why the heck are you still using the Orbitz, number one? You know, come on. If you're still using Orbitz, you deserve to be shown the higher prices because you're a moron. Not because it's an Apple or a PC. You're just a moron.
Nice. So who should we be using then, Analog? You travel more than anybody else.
Well, personally, I'm stuck using my company site. So, but personal travel, I like to use. I go straight to the source. So, I've become very, very, you know, well endowed with Marriott's. So, I like the Marriott systems, and I also like the a lot of the Choice hotels. Yeah, some of them aren't the greatest. So that's why you got to kind of look at a couple different hotel groups. And, I mean, there are several different hotels within each of those groups. So I always look for, the higher 4-star, 3-4-star hotels within those groups in whatever city I'm staying in. But I go straight to the source because it's cheaper, and most times I'm using points anyways.
So you avoid the clearinghouses and just go straight to the hotel chain?
Yeah, the only time I ever use a clearinghouse is if I don't have enough points and I want to go somewhere. I go to Priceline, name your own price, and I always undercut it by at least 50%.
Nice. Cool. All right, well, we'll keep that in mind for the meetup next year. Let's see. Where was I? I have lost my... No, I haven't. Here we go. This next website is hilarious. WeKnowWhatYou'reDoing.com. I wish I had registered that name because that is an amazing URL. This website uses social network API, specifically Facebook's Graph API. And they're pulling and filtering posts, all posts within the past hour that are public. And they filtered them out. They have a column of who wants to get fired, and it's looking for the phrase, I hate my boss. And there were quite a few of them on there. They had another one saying who's hungover, looking for the word hungover, quite a few of those on there. They had who's taking drugs, and it's looking for several different words, but cannabis was the one I saw the most. And there weren't nearly as many people posting about that on Facebook, which is, you know, good to not post that you're taking a drug that's technically Schedule One on, you know, a public forum. Oh, and then the funniest one was who's got a new phone number, because I think it's looking for the word phone and then a string of numbers that, you know, fit the format, or, you know, 10 digits, 334. So...
Damn, they're X-ing out the numbers, though.
Yeah, they are. But here's the funny part. They're exiting at the numbers. If you go to wknowwhatyouredoing.com and then go to the About page, let's see. I think it's down at the bottom.
About this tool?
About the tool. Okay, no, they moved it up to the top.
Right in the middle top, yeah.
Yeah. About this tool, it says, how does it work? And then they give you the URL they're using to... to get the raw JSON output. So if you wanted to get the real phone numbers, you could certainly write a little filter from what they have on this page here and get it going.
Oh, this is so going to be fun later.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going up on my wall of win with right next to my live pick fog feed. Right next to
I thought you guys would appreciate that one. So... yeah, that one was just funny. And so, okay, people have no shame, and I realize this, and this is why there's, this is why on porn sites they've got the plus one and like buttons and retweet this and all this other stuff, and people must click them. But I'm just laughing at what people are posting on a public forum, which Facebook is essentially a big-ass public forum. I mean, you've got people's real names on there saying, I hate my boss, and I'm smoking weed, and I'm drunk right now. I mean, all you need is somebody to, like, you know, hey, I know where this person works. I can make their life a living hell.
Mm-hmm.
So I would recommend a little bit of discretion with what you post on freaking Facebook.
It doesn't refresh very often, though.
No, it doesn't seem to. But
no.
I think one, they got a lot of traffic when it hit one of the news feeds. So I'm wondering if that's slowing it down. Also, too, I'm wondering if somebody's noticed that they're doing that and going to start blocking the URL. Facebook, a lot of these guys tend to do that. Google, hell, just recently blocked a bunch of the convert a YouTube to MP3 sites.
Yep.
Yeah, they recently blocked a bunch of them, so... Sure, they've got a public API, but bullshit if you're not using it the way they like you use it.
And the other live one that Facebook used to do, what was it, the book or something like Livebook?
Yeah.
Or something that's been taken down now. That's not there anymore.
I think Please Rob Me is still up, though. That was one that used, like, Foursquare and Twitter to figure out when people weren't home.
Mm.
But, yeah, this one's just funny, so... You know, it just kind of proves, again, you know, lie on Facebook. Or even better, don't link your Facebook account to stuff that's going to get you in trouble. So.
Yep.
Or even better, just don't link anything to your Facebook account. I mean.
Oh, wait, even better. Don't use Facebook.
There you go. Yeah,
there it is.
Or if you have to use Facebook, set up a resume account. You know, the account you don't care to give your boss when they say, hey, we need your password. Because that's getting to be more and more common. So if you're going to set up a Facebook profile, treat it like a resume. Only put your friends on there who are going to post tasteful things. Only put family on there that's not going to embarrass you. You know, make sure all your photos are wholesome of people standing in a park laughing with salad or whatever the hell it is you do in pictures. And, you know, like not passed out on the floor drunk or naked. And never post anything.
but what if I'm applying for Chippendales?
That's a special circumstance. You know, they tell you in job applications, Cinemarsh to tailor the resume to the job. So if you need to, you know, go out on a few wild benders to spruce up your Facebook profile for the job you're applying for, then, well, you know, modify as necessary.
I'm just looking at some of these profile pictures. They're fucking retarded.
Well, they're publicly posting their phone number on Facebook. I would assume that already. So, which the phone number one's probably the funniest.
Yeah, I'm going back to Minecraft.
There's this one girl on here. She hates her boss so much she wants to kill him herself. So
that's terroristic threatening right now, right there. She's going to jail. So.
I'm going to go look her up on Facebook itself now. Hold on.
Live trolling on Galaxy 15 Radio. Well, while Analog is harassing people on Facebook here, so let's see. This one is from LA Weekly. Now, this is not really a surprise. I'm pretty sure we've talked about this one before. But It's kind of a fun rehash because they're getting ready to expand it. The Long Beach Police Department press released in August 2010 was tellingly brief, just 121 words. Franklin Robes, 33, had been shot to death on his way to buy a used Cadillac, a possible robbery attempt to turn bloody. There was no suspect, no eyewitnesses, and investigators had little to go on, or so it appeared. What Long Beach detectives didn't know was the day of the murder was that the alleged getaway car had already been under police surveillance before Robes' murder was even contemplated. Using a vast and automatic electronic tracking system that is all but unknown to California public, on the day of Robes' murder, police in Los Angeles County cities had made a detailed record of the alleged getaway motor vehicle's movements. The information came complete with GPS coordinates, even photographs. In a situation evoking the hit movie Minority Report, the suspects are being watched even before they were considered suspects. So they're doing pre-crime here. LA Weekly has learned that more than two dozen law enforcement agencies in Los Angeles County are using hundreds of these automatic license plate recognition devices. They're basically taking a picture of your license plate, running OCR on it, and figuring and tracking your car based on the license plate. And the units are about the size of a paperback book, usually mounted atop of a police cruiser, to devour data on every car that catches their electronic eye. The L.A. County Sheriff's Department and Los Angeles Police Department are two of the biggest gatherers of automatic license plate. Blah, 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 blah. They're basically photographing anybody's car. It's just doing it. It's automatically. Documents obtained by the Weekly through California Public Records Act and interviews with officials at LAPD, LBPD, and Sheriff's Department describe one of the most densely concentrated license plate recognition systems in the United States, soon to be linked up with a similar system in San Diego. So, in other words, you know the cameras in police cars? They're actively recording what license plates they see and keeping a track of the GPS locations where they saw them.
Yeah, they can process 3,000 a minute.
Yeah, I skimmed over some of the numbers there just because it was boring.
I know. We've just had them rolled out here, but we also have the thing called the Ring of Steel. It runs around the perimeter of all the major highways into the city, and it photographs you and logs when you go in and out of that area if you're not from the area.
Now, I will say I'm not actually against this. I just want people to be aware that, you know, you are being tracked if you go out in public, period.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't actually have a problem with this for the most part. Now, what happens if the data finds its way, say, outside of a law enforcement database? Well, you could start having problems. You also could start having problems with, you know, wrong place, wrong time. It's just your car happened to be seen near a scene of an accident, so they start mass arresting people. That's abuse of technology. But I'm not actually against the technology itself because I think it could be useful. So
it depends. I'm 50-50.
Yeah, I mean, I don't – I think – I like to think that most cops aren't going to abuse a system like this, but you know that there are some out there that will, and it really only takes one. So
I just get worried that because I know these systems and I try and get around them, not just because I just don't like being photographed and shit, you know, and I pay in cash and I keep my blinds closed. I'm just wondering because I don't participate like a regular sheep that I'm going to get targeted for, even though I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, you'll be profiled.
Just because I'm aware
mm-hmm.
of what's going on.
Now, you want to fuck with them, you get yourself a couple of those high brightness infrared LEDs, you know, the ones that are about the size of a quarter, and wire those into the little illuminator on your license plate so that it blinds the cameras.
Oh, yeah, and then you're going to jail.
Probably. It's like, what? I'm not obstructing my license plate. You can see it fine, can't you, officer?
So, just look into the little laser right there, officer. Oh, it's only a category 3 industrial. You'll be fine. Oh, what? Your retina's burnt out. My bad.
But, yeah, how long is it going to be before you have the barcode and the RFID tag on the back of the license plate anyways? So just, you know, be aware when you're out in public, your car's movements are being tracked. So if you're really needing to ditch government surveillance for one reason or another, don't take your car.
Yeah, but then public transport, now you got facial recognition software hooked up with all the cameras on everything.
So get yourself a mask and go underground, because that's about the only way you're going to do it, and it's going to be on foot. So,
yeah, good luck.
Yep.
So yeah, let's just go buy a military silo and set up a colony and never come out.
you want to be left alone? Why do you want to do that? Don't you like your government? Are you plotting to overthrow your government? Why do you want to be alone?
Because my government terrifies me at the moment, but that's not the point.
Because our president is a fraud and a liar and not born here, and he's been shot in the head, and give me the gun and I'll do it.
Hey, Morps, have you noticed something? It's never the hosts. It's always their guests getting them into trouble.
I'm not even going to comment on that because I do it on your show. So anyways, so let me just rocket snail right into this Torrent Freak story here. Speaking of scary governments, across the world, initiatives are appearing with an aim to increase internet monitoring. In the U.S., file shares will soon be monitored and reported on behalf of the MPAA and the RIAA. In the U.K., there are plans to monitor and store all internet communication. Good God. Somebody buy Western Digital stock right now, or maybe Fujitsu hard drive makers. Buy stock in people who make SANs, because good Lord, if the U.K. is going to log everything. Anyways, countering this increased surveillance, people are turning in mass to VPN services to ensure their privacy. This begs the question, how long before VPNs become illegal? In the coming decade, though, I think in the UK, you could interpret one of the laws they passed as already making them illegal. In the coming decade, there will be an avalanche of initiatives to regulate and monitor the internet. The freedom, privacy, and relative anonymity that people experience today will only be short-lived if the copyright lobby and intelligence agencies have their way. In the U.S., there is CISPA, a bill that would put an end to people's privacy on the internet by allowing companies to spy on internet users. Despite fierce opposition from the online community, the bill was approved by the House of Representatives in April. Another example of increased monitoring in the U.S. is the Six Strikes Anti-Piracy Agreement, in which alleged pirates will be tracked down and punished as part of an agreement ISP signed with the MPAA and RIAA. In the U.K., there are similar developments. Not only are there plans to monitor and warn file sharers, a draft of the communications data bill that was posted yesterday shows that the U.K. government wants to monitor and store the internet activity of its citizens. A scary prospect for many, but as always, there are plenty of ways to circumvent these spying efforts. Privacy-conscious internet users could always switch to many VPN providers and bypass all of the above. Since VPN providers in the U.S. and many other countries are not required to log any user information, but some do, these can't be easily monitored. And the article goes on talking about VPNs and essentially speculates that because these VPNs can be used to circumvent all of this monitoring and privacy controls and identifying who's who on the internet, that at some point governments are going to move to just start banning them.
Yep.
Well, VPNs are a legitimate business tool. I use them where I work, and we don't have a good replacement for them. So if they start banning them, we're going to have a problem.
I don't think they'll be able to ban them. Too many companies use them. Comparative to the actual number of people that use them for illegal purposes, it's outweighed by the number of companies that actually use them profitable purposes and government agencies that actually use them. So, yeah, it's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Well, they might get really, really fancy with it. Like, oh, well, if you're running a public VPN and selling access, you have to log. And well, that's essentially what they tell the telephone companies. They have to do this logging and make it easier for them to wiretap, so they could just do the same thing. So, yeah. I'm going to jump around here because I've got another. I'm going to jump down to the story after the next one. So, I'm confusing you guys with the notes, sorry. But because we were talking about VPNs, I wanted to hit this one. There is a site I came across in my newsfeed called Zacebook, ZACEbook.com. And they have a page where they're saying, here's a free VPN account. And the title of it's literally 100% totally free USA IP PPTP VPN, you know, and then a little smiley. And the guy's message on there literally says, because, you know, screw censorship. Now, I'm bringing up the site because it scares the hell out of me. If you're a law enforcement agency and you wanted to track people doing bad stuff on the internet, would you not set up something like this? You know, just to log the hell out of all of it so you could then prosecute people.
If it seems too good to be true.
Absolutely.
Buy it anyway.
Now, I took a look at some of the PHP code on the site. It's generated from a template, and it's weird. I didn't see anything malicious. It's just very sloppy, and it looks like it. Honestly, it looks like they took a WordPress theme and gutted it and made HTML pages, which is a weird way to do it, but it's weird looking. And the other thing I wanted to point out about this site is that when you join a VPN, you're put on a network, you know, and it gets one of the points of VPNs is to get around firewalls. If I wanted to spread some malware that, say, went over Windows file shares, it's running a VPN is a great way to do it because it puts everybody on my local network past their firewall and router and likely expose, like if they've got Windows file sharing turned on, which a lot of people do because it's on by default, that exposes a lot of stuff to some random network out there on the internet and potentially everybody else on it. So even if the people running the VPN aren't malicious, somebody else could be. So I'm going to recommend not using some random-ass VPN service that does everything short of put the Guy Fox mask on and announce that Anon never forgives. Well, I mean, seriously, if you go look at the page, the way it's written, you tell me that's not, you know, it doesn't look like an anonymous page and everything but announcing it supports anonymous. I mean, if you need a VPN service, go get a reputable one for $5. And if you need to anonymize or get around censorship, use Tor. That's what it's for.
Yeah,
true.
So I wanted to point it out that you see these things pop up every once in a while. It's like, oh yeah, here's a free VPN, and of course he's got a PayPal donate box on there and everything else. And it's just, it could be totally legit. Could just be some kid who set up a VPN, you know, like out of his dorm or something, and thinks he's doing the world a favor. In fact, given the sloppiness of the way the website's coded, it very well could be. But I would question anything, because like if I wanted to work for a law enforcement agency and gather data on people, this is certainly one way to do it. You know, half the Tor nodes are ran by the FBI. You do know that, right? So
what?
Well, maybe not half of them, but a number of them are ran by government agencies because that way they can log what goes on through them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, also if you're using Tor, make sure you use more than, you know, two hops. Thing is, the technology in Tor is sound, so it's not as, you know, the FBI running an Exynos node is not actually that bad of a thing as long as you've got it set up right. But it's like, oh, I'll just use one hop, that way it's nice and fast. You're missing the point.
If it's not taking 2 minutes to load the page, you're doing it wrong.
That's right. So scrolling back up here, this is actually a follow-up story because we talked about it, last year, I think. Remember we had the story about the guy from the UK who ran TV Shack, and they're extraditing him to the U.S., even though he's never set foot in the U.S. before. All of his servers were in the U.K., all this other crazy stuff.
Kim.com.
Well, Kim.com, too, but this guy is... This is the student. This is the student in the U.K. who they're trying to extradite to the States so they can prosecute him for criminal copyright. He ran TV Shack, which was essentially a search engine.
Okay.
So...
Yeah, no, I didn't follow this story.
Okay, well, I found it just scary as hell because they were essentially grabbing a UK citizen saying, you ran a website, and because we get hit in the States, we're going to prosecute you in the States and extradite you to the States. It's like, wait a minute. So, but anyways, Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales is helping Richard O'Dwyer, a UK-based ex-administrator of the video linking website TV Shack, to prevent him from being extradited to the States for alleged copyright infringements. According to Wales, the case is an example of the ever-growing influence of the copyright lobby over the internet. Richard O'Dwyer is the human face of the battle between the content industry and the interests of the public, of the general public, Wales states. Last year, Richard O'Dwyer was arrested by police for operating TV Shack, a website that lists user-submitted links to TV shows. The UK student has since fought a looming extradition to the US, but thus far without success. In March, Home Secretary Theresa May officially announced the extradition request from US authorities. The controversial extradition based on alleged copyright infringements is now awaiting an appeal to the High Court later this year. However, if it's up to Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales, it won't get that far. Today, Wales launched a petition, I think this was on the 24th, on change.org asking the UK Home Secretary to stop the extradition. Wales, who earlier met with Richard O'Dwyer, believes the student has done little wrong. When operating his site, Richard O'Dwyer did his best to play by the rules. On the few occasions he receives requests to remove content from copyright holders, he complied. His site hosted links, not copyrighted content, and these were submitted by users, Wales writes. So, essentially, the founder of Wikipedia is trying to help this kid out because we've talked about it before. What happened with this guy is he ran TV Shack, and you know they threatened him, and he shut the site down. And now they're still trying to sue him. Actually, I think they're trying to get criminal copyright on him. And so they went to the UK government and said, we want to extradite this guy to the States so we can prosecute him under US law. Except he's never set foot in the States. His servers were never operated in the States. And honestly, you could argue that he hasn't actually done anything wrong because all he did was link to videos. He didn't actually host any of them.
Yes, these charges terrify me.
Yeah, it scares me too. That's why I'm talking about it.
I mean, like, you can sort of see where Julian Assange has done a runner. Being tried in the United States is probably one of my nightmares. You know, well, I'd rather be in a group orgy with zombies than be prosecuted by the United States for a crime, especially against copyright.
Well, with the zombies, you've got the chance of being immune, right? So,
well, I got a chance. You know? I got a fighting chance.
With the copyright, because I'm not sure if they have something equivalent in the UK to things like the DMCA and some of the copyright laws that we have over here. So I think that's probably why they're doing the extradition, is to get the laws over here where they're more favorable to the copyright lobby. It's just a little bit scary that they're, you know, because the UK and the US have good relations, they're able to just pick this kid up, pull him over here, and now they're going to prosecute him.
Right.
So that's just a little bit scary.
So if my throat was feeling better, I've got a lot more to say on that, so hit me up for next time.
Yeah, sorry about that, are you?
Right, man.
All right, this next one here is, this story's from all over the place. The particular copy I have is from the NZ Herald.co.nz, it's the New Zealand Herald. The High Court has ruled that the police raid on internet entrepreneur Ken.com's Auckland mansion was illegal and that the removal from New Zealand of cloned copies of hard drives seized was unlawful. Justice Helen Winkleman found the warrants used did not adequately describe the offenses to which they were related. Indeed, they fell well short of that. They were general warrants, and as such, were invalid. So, in other words, they issued warrants saying you can go in this guy's house and look for whatever you want. A spokesman for .com's attorney said .com and his co-defendants were pleased. No, I would think so. They are very happy with Justice Winkleman's decisions, wrote a representative for Simpson Gerson. We are considering our client's remedies as a result of the decision that the search warrants were unlawful and that the FBI sending the clones to the USA was also unlawful. Police said they were considering the judgment and are in discussions with Crown Law to determine what further action might be required. They would not make any comment until that process was complete. Justice Winkleman's judgment, released a short time ago, found the warrants were far too wide in terms of scope of the search and the amount of items they gave police authority to seize. These categories of items were defined in such a way that they would inevitably capture within them both relevant and irrelevant material. Police acted on this authorization. The warrants could not authorize seizure of irrelevant material and therefore invalid. The cloning of .com's hard drives by the FBI, who took copy disks back to the U.S., was also ruled as invalid because .com had never given consent. The court ordered an independent lawyer to review everything seized in the raid to determine what is relevant to the investigation and what is not. Relevant material will be released to the U.S. authorities, and everything else will be returned to .com forthwith. So, essentially, what this judge has figured out is technical. It said, well, you didn't write out the warrants correctly. You made them way too broad. So, and we all know that they were just making an example at a mega upload, because even by U.S. law, they've essentially violated his constitutional rights, in my opinion, because they shut down his business without due process. I mean, they didn't just start suing him and he had to shut down as a result of it. They went in and shut down his business.
He was found guilty before he was even found, even in court.
Right. And now that they're going back through the legal process, they're figuring out they fucked up. So,
either way, still, it doesn't get him off the hook. It just gives him a little breathing room.
Well, if they don't, with that, that means that the chances of New Zealand actually approving an extradition to the U.S. go down, because suddenly a lot of their evidence has to be thrown out.
Yeah.
So he might not have to come back over here. If he ever set foot in the U.S., though, they'd seize him and he'd be in court.
Oh, yeah.
So he may never be able to return to the U.S., which sucks, but...
Eh.
I think he's from the States, though, is he?
Yeah, he is. He moved to New Zealand for tax reasons.
I thought he was in South African.
Who, oh, was he?
Had a, yeah, I thought he was South African who had his business in Hong Kong and then went to New Zealand for the lifestyle.
Well, I thought he got kicked out of a couple of countries, too, so I don't know.
We'll get back to him.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. But dot-com's no angel here, but I do think they were making an example out of him. So
yeah.
Let's see. Okay, this next one's just cool. And yes, it's from the army.mil, so it might be biased. Doesn't matter. It's just cool. Scientists and engineers at the Picanti Arsenal are busy developing a device that will shoot lightning bolts down laser beams to destroy targets. Soldiers and science fiction fans, you're welcome. We never got tired of the lightning bolt zapping our simulated targets, said George Fisher, lead scientist on the... That's what you want your lead scientist, wild-haired. We love zapping shit.
Quick, Marty, get in the car. We have to go back.
That is totally what I picture. George Fisher looks like freaking Dr. Brown. And, you know, they were shooting at a DeLorean with the lasers and the lightning bolts. But, I mean, the laser-induced plasma channel, or LIPIC, is designed to take out targets that conduct electricity better than air or ground that surrounds them. How did the scientists harness the seemingly random path made by lightning bolts, and how does a laser help? To understand the technology, it helps to get a brief background of the physics. Light travels more slowly in gases and solids than it does in a vacuum, explained Fisher. We typically think of the speed of light in each material as constant. However, there's a very small additional intensity-dependent factor in its speed. In air, its factor is positive, so light slows down by a tiny fraction when the light is more intense. If a laser puts out a pulse with modest energy, but the time is incredibly tiny, the power can be huge, Fisher continued. So, okay, I'm going to skip some of this. Essentially, what they're doing is using a high-power laser pulse to make a plasma channel with a tiny amount of vacuum in it. And that conducts electricity way better than air. So essentially, you're taking the air, taking this plasma channel, and giving a large lightning, you know, giving a lightning bolt a path.
Nice. So okay. We're going back to valves and tubes again.
Yeah, essentially, except it's made out of lasers and air, which is awesome. And anyways, the plasma channel conducts electricity way better than unionized air, so when we set up the laser that the filament comes near a high-voltage source, the electrical energy will travel down the filament. And by filament, we're talking about the little, you know, bit of plasma and vacuum there. A target, an enemy vehicle, or even some type of unexploded ordnance, would be a better conductor than the ground it sits on, since voltage drop across the target would be the same as the voltage drop across the same distance of ground, current flows to the target. In the case of unexploded ordnance, it would detonate. So essentially what they've done is taken a Tesla coil, so they have a source of lightning, and a high-power laser. And I cut off a good chunk of the article here. They go into how they made sure that they wouldn't accidentally have, you know, the lightning travel up into the laser, and they got really specific about, you know, the air focusing as a lens. There's some physics behind that. It's all high-speed physics. But yeah, they've got a laser that shoots lightning. I mean, granted, this is high-end beta stuff. They've probably got, like, you know, the prototype, and that's it. And it's probably freaking huge. So don't expect to see these on tanks anytime soon. But, I mean, come on, that's badass. We're getting the laser guns.
Put on shocks, man. Shock lasers.
I want this thing in a rifle. I mean, if you think about it, what you have is a laser with a Tesla coil tied on the end of it. This is going to look like something out of the 1950s, you know, what they thought the future would look like with the little balls and the antennas and everything on them.
Wow. Yeah.
No. You're thinking on the wrong scale here. This is Border Patrol.
Oh, Well, yeah, you could build towers out of these things, put a computer, mm-hmm. you know, put a computer targeting system in it, and you essentially have the Tesla towers from Red Alert.
Oh, badass, man.
I mean, you know, granted, this stuff's all probably, you know, more than 10 years out, but they've got the prototype. So, and I just love this lead scientist. You know, what was his exact line here? I don't want to get it wrong. We never got tired of the lightning bolts zapping our simulated targets. I mean, you can just see this guy being all wide-eyed and be like, yeah, lightning.
Can I build one of these to stop dogs from shitting on my lawn?
So, and speaking of, you know, just fun, badass shit, last one is actually from RT.com, Russia Today. There are a lot of cool things you can do with $1,000, but scientists at Austin, Texas College have come across one that is often overlooked. For less than a grand, how'd you like to hijack a U.S. government drone? A group of researchers led by Professor Todd Humphreys from the University of Texas at Austin Radio Navigation Laboratory recently succeeded in raising the eyebrows of the U.S. government, because that's always a good idea. With just around $1,000 in part, Humphrey's team took control of an unmanned aerial vehicle operated by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. After being challenged by his lab, the DHS dared Humphrey's crew to hack into their drone and take command. Much to their chagrin, that's exactly what they did. So in other words, they went to the DHS and said, we think we can hack your drones, and the DHS kind of laughed and said, yeah, try it. So they did.
Nice.
Humphreys tells Fox News that for a few $100, his team was able to spoof the GPS system on board the DHS drone, a technique that involves mimicking the actual signals sent to the GPS devices, and then eventually tricking the target into following a new set of commands. And for just $1,000, Humphreys said that the spoofer and his team assembled was one of the most sophisticated ones ever built. Spoofing a GPS receiver on a UAV is just another way of hijacking a plane, Humphreys tells Fox. The real danger here is that the government is currently considering plans that will allow local law enforcement agencies and other organizations coast to coast to control drones of their own in America's airspace. In 5 to 10 years, we'll have 30,000 drones in the airspace, he tells Fox News. Each one of these could be a potential missile used against us, so they're talking about people hacking into them to use them for weapons.
I don't think they should be using it on civilians, man.
No, like, they shouldn't, but they're going to. I was just thinking it'd be better to land one of these things and steal the cameras out of it, because you know they've got to be good cameras.
Oh, hell yeah.
Or actually, a lot of things you could get out of these things. You steal the drone, just make sure you pull the radio out and stomp on it so they can't track it. But if you're gonna hack a drone, when you down it, grab a hammer and a mask. So that the last photo they get is, you know, somebody in an Anon mask coming up and smacking the radio with a hammer.
Nah, don't do it in an Anon mask, man. Do it in a pedo bear mask. Or a Mickey Mouse or something.
Yeah, something. I just, first, you know, whatever. You know, just ski mask, whatever. Just, you know, if they've got a picture of you, they're going to go back to their face tracking that they use when they're getting the, you know, license plates and figure out who the hell's got their drone. So, anyways. Yeah, so, you know, these college kids with $1,000 worth of equipment took over a Homeland Security drone, which is just badass.
It's going to happen more and more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, anyways, so now we're going to get to this.
Me love you long time.
So, I thought for Digital Dojo tonight we could talk about password cracking. Because I've been playing a little bit of Fallout, and the way you crack passwords in Fallout, at first when they show the scripted typing in a terminal to pull up, you know, get it into single user mode and start messing around with the accounts file, that's actually not terribly far off. But then they do the same thing every movie and game always does, is they show that bullshit scene where you have the password field being filled in one character at a time as all the random characters are tried. It's nothing like that. It doesn't work that way. If you got to guess things one character at a time, it would be a hell of a lot easier to do that hacking.
I know, man. It's so much better than that. It's like you're flying around inside the Gibson. Oh, fuck. No, it's not.
No. You're again, wrong movie.
Damn. Oh, you're real life? You mean sitting there drinking coffee after coffee after coffee, waiting for a fucking program to finish running?
Watching the progress bar go by. That's right. So... anyways, so I thought I would talk about some actual real methods of password cracking, because enough people seem to think it's like the movies where you hook a random circuit board up to a credit card reader and the ATM spits out money. It's like, no, that doesn't actually work. I'm sorry.
It's a lot easier to find out the default puck code, which is usually a four-digit number, and just change the denomination draws. So when you take out a 20, it gives you a 50, and then just swap it back after, kids.
Yeah, that one works. Actually, I found a good one the other day. I was helping a family member with their machine, and I had brought a CD from work that was the Symantec Endpoint Recovery Disk. It was it's a live CD that Symantec puts out that runs Windows PE for doing a system scan when you think it's too malwared up to actually boot into Windows.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like using a Linux live CD, except it's a specialized tool, and I didn't have time to put something together, so I just grabbed that. Well, it turns out the damn thing wants the serial number. Now, I've actually got legitimate access to the serial, but I didn't have it with me. So I just put it in all nines, and it worked. They left the test code active in the damn thing.
Nice.
So, yeah, just, you know, remember when you need a serial for something, try something dumb like all zeros or all nines or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Because a lot of times these test codes are still in the system.
Yeah, don't overthink it. That can be your biggest problem when going at something. You know, overthinking it.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially if you're talking about a live target, like a machine in a shop or something like that,
yeah,
if you're on the fly.
So anyway, so just some of your simpler methods for password cracking. I thought we'd start with the easy ones. First up is just straight up password brooding. Brooding is trying to guess the password until you find the one that works. Just mm-hmm. a second.
You're sick too. You're turning, you bastard.
Eh, so much for being immune. Anyways, it's your fault, man. Talking with that, you know, talking with that video game character voice, it's hurting my throat. Getting
analog. Take one shovel and see Morps in the morning.
Anyways, so password brooding is simply trying to guess the password until you find one that works. You don't get to guess one character at a time. It's almost always all or nothing. Very occasionally, you'll find ones where it's a chunk or nothing. For example, Landman hashes are 8 characters and then this latter 8 characters, so you can actually crack those, you know, 8 characters at a time.
Yep.
And the WPA pins are similar. They're cut in half. Instead of 1 8-digit pin, it's 2 4-digit pins. So very rarely will you ever get to do something where it's, you know, parts of it at a time. It's nice when you find them, but more often than not, it's the password or nothing. You don't get to do this one character wrong, two characters. Like if you've done the hacking in Fallout where it says, oh, pick a word, and then it tells you how many letters are right. Yeah, it's not like that. Nothing, you know, the program doesn't come back, oh, you got 1 character out of 5. Try again. No, it just says wrong password.
I wish it did.
Well, think if it did. Think, I mean, it would just be so ridiculous because you couldn't use a password. It wouldn't be a way of going. So anyways, though, I wanted to point that out. Now, and it really is, it's called brute force because it is rather dumb. I mean, you literally have a computer program. The probably two most popular ones are John the Ripper and THC Hydra, which I've got links to in the show notes, which literally sit there and run through a dictionary password. Actually, I think you can set John the Ripper to generate passwords.
There's little to no learning curve on John the Ripper.
Yeah, no, it's literally...
The most fun you're going to have with it is, password lists. And you become a junkie, start searching Pastebin for hours and hours for password lists.
I set up an SSH honeypot to give me mine. I've got some pretty good ones. But anyways, literally, it just tries passwords to see if something gets in. Now, live brooding, in other words, going after a live service on a network, like you were talking about earlier, you know, the PC in the shop that's on, it's rather obvious, and usually it doesn't work for a whole host of reasons. Whenever you try to connect to a system and it gives you 3 tries to the password and then you got to close the browser and reopen it or whatever, that's actually trying to prevent brute forcing. The ones that just close the connection and reopen it are pretty dumb because you can script around that. Some of them actually start asking for CAPTCHAs after a few bad logins. I know Google Mail does that. You punch in a bad password a couple of times, it starts bringing up a CAPTCHA anytime you open it with your IP for a bit until you log in successfully or a couple hours or something like that. I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, Hotmail's the same.
But
3 fails and it's CAPTCHAs.
It's CAPTCHA time, yeah. And they do that to try to prevent the whole just sitting there guessing passwords till you get in. because and this is why they're called dictionary files, where you keep a list of passwords and a list of usernames, and generally the first thing you start with is the dictionary, because you know how many people use, you know, puppies, flowers, God, sex, love, you know, pick your password list, right?
Horse porn. Now you have to change yours big.
Yeah, a lot of them actually use things like the site name too. So, you know, how many people's Facebook password is Facebook? It's a lot.
It's coffee cup. Yeah. Pen, keyboard, phone.
Common names. You know, a lot of people use their kids' names for passwords, pet names, stuff like that.
I don't know about you, Morbs, but I went and altered mine and chucked I in front of a lot of words. So like iPhone, iDick, things like that. You know, for all those Apple fans out there.
The new Apple iDick for when your penis just isn't shiny enough. Anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not really going to get into my password scheme. However, it involves math.
Anyway.
So it's rather screwball, actually.
And if it works, it works.
It works. So anyways, but so that's the first one. And brooding is usually the first and last thing you try. You know, the first thing you do is throw the dumb password list at a box you're trying to get into just to see if somebody set a stupid password. And then when all else fails, you go back to brooding. Because the truth is, if you go into John the Ripper and set it to just start generating all possible passwords up to a certain character range, you will eventually get in. It might take decades, but it will eventually get you a functioning password, assuming the service doesn't just lock your IP and call it a day. So,
but if you are trying a Facebook or something like that, try and harvest some information from that person in their own world to start with.
Oh, yeah.
Narrow down
definitely.
Your search times.
Definitely. You know? And I'll get into that stuff here in a bit. So next thing to look at, which is sort of like brooding, it's related to brooding, but it's a little different. It's called rainbow tables. Now, what a rainbow table is instead of sitting there trying to guess the password, you figure out what a service is storing the password as. Usually they hash them. A hash is a one-way function where you get a semi-random string, back based on what you put in it, and it's always the same, you know, based on your password. That way you're not actually storing the password in clear text. You're storing this generated hash in a table. And the idea is if you have the hash, well, that's great, but it doesn't tell you what the original password was. And without the original password, you can't actually log in because of the way the hashing is done. So what a rainbow table is you take that same dictionary file we were talking about using with John the Ripper or THC Hydra.
Yep.
And you run every word in it through the hashing function and save it. So if you know that all the passwords for a forum, for example, are stored as an MD5 hash, well, you run your dictionary through the MD5 hasher and save the output. And then you find some other way to dump the hashes from that forum. Generally, you find a code injection, or you find, you know, something stupid with the database, or you know maybe they've got something set publicly where you can somehow get your hands on the hashes from that system. And then you simply look them up in your table to see if you have a password for them. This is what a lot of people were trying to do with those LinkedIn passwords that were dumped a couple of weeks back.
Okay.
So it's a rather simple process, but rainbow tables, first of all, get huge. Like, you can go online and buy them because they take that long to generate. So you can go online and buy a terabyte drive with rainbow tables. They'll usually tack $20 onto the cost of the drive and mail it to you because that's actually more efficient than getting on BitTorrent and trying to download them.
Yeah, I can imagine.
They get huge quick because, you know, sure, it's not so bad when you're going through just the dictionary, but then you start doing things like all combinations of letters and numbers up through 8 characters hashed. Mm. And, you know, these things take forever to generate, especially when you're dealing with different kinds of hashing. MD5, SHA-1, LANMAN, WPA. I mean, these are just the common ones. You start getting into some of the more esoteric ones that some various programs use, you know, some of the different kind of hashing and password storage algorithms that are out there. And, the other thing is if they're using SALT, you know, they're doing something to change the way they hash. Like, maybe it's appending something to the end of the password before they hash it, hashing it twice. There's tons of different ways to vary it. You've just invalidated all those rainbow tables.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
Just a few minor notes. On hashing, there is another problem, which is called a collision attack. And that's where if your hash isn't complex enough, you might end up with two different inputs that give you the same hash. You don't see it so much in passwords because there's usually enough entropy there, but you see it a lot when you're trying to get the hash of files. For things like signing certificates and stuff like that. In fact, that's what Flame did, was they found a collision with a Microsoft hash for one of their certificates. That's how they were signing things as Windows updates, is they found a collision attack. But so you don't see it so much, but occasionally you might find two things that hash to the same value. And that means that even though it might not be the password you're punching in, it'll be another password that works and gets you into an account. So, and you don't actually know if you found a collision attack or the real password. Generally, because of the length of passwords, you can assume you found the real password. But if it works, who cares, right? So,
exactly.
And as I was saying, these tables are huge, but they save an amazing amount of time if the password's in them. Because as opposed to sitting there trying to guess the password and run it through the system, if you've got the hash, you just look it up. Right, it's a database call, right? It takes a couple of minutes based on the size of the thing. But that's better than letting it run for decades trying to just crack it, right?
Definitely.
So you look it up in the hash table, and boom, you've got the password. You're done. Now, I've got some links to a couple of different programs here. All of these links, by the way, use your GPU to generate the hashes as opposed to your CPU. Because that's faster. So the first one I've got to insidepro.com, which, by the way, their forum is where all those LinkedIn password hashes were dumped. The Inside Pro forums are just great if you want to have a laugh and go in there and look at, you know, people who've dumped hashes from whatever and they're asking for help cracking them.
Nice.
Great set of forums, totally underground, totally, you know, a lot of people there who think they're badass, and great fun. Just great fun to explore. I wouldn't actually post anything there personally, but it's great fun to troll. Anyways, the next one is I got an article. It's actually for an older version of Backtrack, but it works just the same. It's an offensive security article, and it lists a couple of different things using your GPU in Backtrack for generating hashes. The first one is Pyrit, which Pyrit is a Python script for generating WPA hashes. And then the other one's the CUDA Multiforcer, which is more of a generalized hashing program. And then the last one I have is a question defense article, which actually is a nice walkthrough of using OCL Hashcat to generate hashes on your graphics card in Backtrack.
Okay.
So you use your GPUs to generate them. You know, same rigs that you use to do your Bitcoin mining are great for making password hashes. Exact same process, actually, by the way. So it's you know, you can go online and look up rainbow tables, and these things get huge. So, but that's like people who hack forums and get in there and dump out the password hashes, and you see this stuff all the time about, oh, you know, X number of password hashes were dumped on Pastebin the other day, and they had email accounts associated with them. A lot of times when you see database dumps where the, you know, where whatever's been hacked, you'll see an email address, a username, and then the hash or the password. Yep. And amazingly enough, one of the easiest ways to crack some of these hashes is to try Googling them. Because you'll find rainbow tables that have been posted online and indexed by Google. So you just search the hash and see if it finds a match.
Nice.
So that especially MD5 hashes, you find that a lot, but it doesn't work as much as it used to. I think they started filtering some of that because people were doing that. But if you've got a really dumb password hash and you just don't happen to have a rainbow table, just throw it in Google and see if it finds something. Landman hashes, stuff like that, especially, you know, the dumber passwords, they'll probably show up. So just a thought there. And then finally, you've got systematic attacks. And these aren't really so much actually cracking the password. It's just finding a way to not have to worry about a password. First and foremost, if the system stores it in clear text, yeah, you find a code inject just like you'd get the hash, and then you get the actual password. And there's an amazing number of systems out there that still store shit in the clear. You wouldn't think, but they do. Older forums, older websites, just, you know, people weren't thinking when they wrote them. So another way is to try to social engineer the password, literally just ask for it. It's like, you know, hi, yep. This is Bob Hackerman. I'm the system password inspector. There's an amazing number of people that will just give you your password if you give them a plausible line.
Hackerman, I've got to do that one.
Just see if anybody catches it.
Yeah.
You know, another thing, you can look up the Marks, Facebook, and other social networks and try to figure out the answers to their password reset questions. You know, all these websites now, it's like, oh, where were you born? What was your mother's maiden name? What was your high school? Well, if they've got their Facebook profile public, I bet most of that stuff's in there.
Just go to their mother's Facebook page or whatever and see if you can find it that way. If not, then use is it Genealogy? Looking up your family shit online, a lot of that's
there's tons been of them.
Indexed on Google. Use your basic tools if you're going to socially engineer the password out of them. Try and guess it.
Yep. So, you know, that stuff just kind of ends around it. And then finally, you can sometimes find SQL injection in a password field in places you wouldn't expect. Offensive Security has a great video demonstrating, I think it's a Backtrack 4, it's an older video, where they show somebody had rigged up a FTP server to store its credentials in a database. So you could do a SQL injection on the FTP login line. So that's, you know, something good to check. Just sometimes you can do the, you know, closing tick or 1=1 and see if that'll get you past a password box. Sometimes you can find a code inject and just not even have to worry about a password in some of these apps that were written before anybody thought about code injects or where people didn't know about them or didn't care. A lot of internal systems you'll find, you know, where like a company wrote their own little program to just do something. You'll find, especially with older systems where they've got like AS400s and bunches of custom scripts and stuff like that, you'll find these little internal applications that are full of these kind of code injection holes, which you would think are just dumb. It's like, that shouldn't even be, you know, nobody should have these kind of holes anymore. But what they did was they took a sysadmin who's not a programmer and by no means a security expert and said, well, we need this application. Go read a book and write it. A lot of those are floating around out there. So once you get into a network, if you can find one of these internal applications, a lot of times you can find some interesting stuff, especially with code injects.
Quick question there, Morps. Because you've been around a long time now because you're getting old and you need a prostate check.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it.
You're right, man. Would you say the up-and-coming generation of security experts are better than the older generation?
No.
Or I'll have a lot more to fucking learn.
Well, the problem is a lot of the ones coming up now, when I was learning this shit, Metasploit didn't exist. Nmap was buggy as hell and would crash, you know, systems as it scanned them. A lot of the times you had to sit there with Netcat or, you know, put stuff in by hand, and a lot of people were... When I was learning this stuff, the argument was that script kiddies were anyone who used a tool they didn't write themselves, which is utter bullshit, but that was the argument that was going on at the time I was learning a lot of this stuff. So... you know, it's like those great useless books, you know, Secrets of a Super Hacker. That was the thing, man. And, you know, nowadays, you know, you've got Nessus, you've got Metasploit, you know, Core Impact, all these other tools. You can literally just sit down and load up on tools. You can just pull down Backtrack. You don't even have to really know what you're doing, and you can do a fairly passable security audit. So you've got a lot of people who don't really understand what they're doing, but they're tool jockeys, which... Like, I've been exploring doing music, and I would say I'm a tool jockey in music because I don't know how to make a patch, but I'm using a lot of other people's. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it does mean that you're going to have a lot of people out there who, you know, they run the scan, say the system's insecure, and they don't even really know what it means. It's like, it says you've got a code injection on this site. Well, does that matter? It might not.
So you're going to have essentially the same problem we had in the early 80s is the kid that can't get a job because his parents couldn't afford the schooling, couldn't get credentials, is going to be hacking systems because he knows them inside out because it's not his job. You know, he just works at McDonald's or something.
You see that a bit now. But
okay.
You've got a lot of tool jockeys out there. And there's nothing – I just really wish people would go beyond – the tool jockey. I don't think you need to go down and understand, you know, what the computer's doing at an electrical level. I mean, hell, it's not like I could sit down with a soldering iron and build one up from scratch. I have an idea of what's going on down that low, but I won't claim to be able to do that. But you know, it's helpful to know what's really going on under the hood. If, for example, if you have to go test a system, but if you crash the system, you're gonna, you know, put the company under. Well, you might want to know what you're throwing at it before you hit that scan button, because, for example, Metasploit Pro has a scheduled. It has a system in it for doing scheduled audits of machines. Well, what it's really doing is it's running, you know, scans and then exploits against systems in a scheduled automated manner. And then so you sit down and you've got a report saying, oh, here's 200 shells on a network. Well, what you don't know is that half the exploits in the Metasploit framework will crash a service. That's how they work. My favorite, everybody's favorite, you know, Windows exploit, MS-0867, if you don't target it correctly, I mean, its auto-targeting is pretty good, but if you tell MS-0867 you're hitting an XP box and it's actually a Windows 2000 box, you will blue screen that box. So, because you don't, if you don't know what these things are doing in the background and you just think you're hitting the button and getting a, you know, getting a shell, well, that's great, but if you don't understand what the tool's actually doing, you're going to make yourself a lot of problems. It's like the joke I used to make about people pulling down CAN and ABLE and then being surprised that their netbook couldn't pass as, you know, a high-end router. So, you know, they you know, it's like, well, CAN and ABLE gets me passwords. Well, great. Do you know what it's actually doing? Well, no. Okay, it's actually running, you know, it does ARP spoofing and runs everyone's traffic through your laptop. So there becomes a point where the size of the network means your laptop can't handle it, and you're going to knock the whole thing over, and instead of getting passwords, you're just going to piss people off.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, build a lab or at least set up virtual machines and try to understand what the tool is doing before you run it in a live system. So and we've talked about this before with setting up labs. There's a reason it's not terribly expensive anymore to set up a little test network and do it yourself. One of the reasons people used to hack and break into networks is to try stuff because they couldn't get their hands on it on their own.
Well, they didn't have the systems at home to run it.
Right. Well, these days everyone's can get, you know, you can get on eBay and get a laptop for $100. So you can set up a small test network fairly cheap. And not that I'm saying $100 is cheap. I'm just saying that, you know, if you put the work into it and you ask around and get old systems from people, you can set up a testing network for cheap and you don't have to go breaking into other people's networks to test crap.
And I think, man, if you're at that point where you're looking to set up a lab, it means you're pretty serious into computers. You've probably got two or three old ones sitting behind you anyway.
Yeah, or just, hell, ask around. I bet you got people. I've got machines that I have them literally because other people just didn't want to look at them anymore. It's like, it's taking up space. I don't want it. You can have it.
Yeah.
And they, because they know I love having old computers kicking around. So, you know, make sure people know you're looking for old boxes. They'll give them to you.
Yeah.
Companies, actually, because they have to pay the recycling. A lot of times when they're upgrading systems, if, you know, you can say, hey, I'll take care of that for you. And they'll give you the old box. They know what you're going to do with it. You're going to set it up at home. Well, they don't care because they don't have to pay the recycling to get rid of it.
Do you have what they call hard rubbish days over there?
Like
twice a year, man, you could drag any shit out to the curb, man, and the council will come along and pick it up in a flatbed truck.
So
people will drag fridges and stuff out, man. We have those twice a year, and I go around driving around looking for machinery on the side of the road.
Nice.
If it's out there, you just chuck in the back of the car, man. LCD screens, you name it.
No, if you want to get rid of that kind of stuff, you get to drive it to the dump and pay. But anyways, so just a few other minor notes on passwords. Password complexity is important, but a lot of your attacks simply end around it or get you to give the password to the attacker in some other way. So, you know, if you've got somebody in your face saying, oh, no, you've got to have, you know, 5 special characters and the password has to be 50 characters long and blah, 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 blah. That stuff is good. Don't misunderstand. But if it's making it impossible to use the system because the passwords are so damn complex, you might need to examine that a little bit.
And if the company asks you every 3 months to roll your password, don't use your original password and add a 1 and then a 2 and then a 3 and then a fuck me.
Yeah. And getting onto my next point there, changing your password every once in a while is a good idea, but a lot of systems do overdo it with that whole 3 months thing, so you get that habit of, you know, just increasing the number on the end, which is bad, because a lot of password lists have the 0 through 9 on the end of them because they know people do that.
Yep.
So, and you know, just some fun stuff. If a system can send you back your password if you forget it, that means they're storing it in the clear. Which means if somebody hacks into their network, they're going to get your passwords. This is why it's a good idea to use different passwords for different systems. Like, you know, some people use, and I do it too. I've got passwords. I got, you know, throwaway passwords that if I'm just on some forum or some bullshit site and I have to make an account, I'll use the same password so I don't have to remember different ones for different sites. But, you know, for stuff that's important, they all get their own password. That way, if one of them gets compromised, I don't, you know, have to go reset every system immediately.
Yep.
So, and other things can happen besides their sites getting hacked. You could get a keylogger on your box. Or if you have to borrow somebody else's machine, they may have a keylogger on it. And you wouldn't think they're that prevalent, but when people decided to start stealing World of Warcraft accounts, you saw keyloggers everywhere. And most of your big name malwares, you know, Zeus, you know, Flame, all of them have keyloggers in them these days. So if your machine gets infected, you can just assume it's going to have a keylogger. There's man-in-the-middle attacks, especially if you're on things like, say, open Wi-Fi or somebody else's network. You know, anything that sends a password in the clear, old-school FTP, old-school Telnet, hell, even some of the old-school VNC stuff sends the password in the clear. A lot of stuff that doesn't go over SSL is still sending it in the clear. And they're still finding websites where passwords pass in the clear. So if somebody knows what they're watching for, they can just get them out of the network traffic. And, you know, that's why I had clear text auth in the notes there. So, you know, you just got to, it's a pain in the ass is what it is. Because you have a lot of systems that are architected badly and a lot of systems that were just designed before anybody really thought about passwords as anything beyond just identifying the user.
Yeah. Whoa, computers, nobody will know anything about these.
Yeah, pretty much. I just realized we went way long, so I'm going to go ahead and close it out here. Of course, promos, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Literally, I'm working on a new system for broadcasting. We like new music. Use the feedback forums. Let us know about new music that's either Creative Commonly licensed, or if you're the artist, you're willing to give us permission to play it. Pure Decking every Thursday, Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays, NR7 whenever RU gets around to beating, you know, BSV to do it. Let's see. The Galaxy 15 radio site and the Twitter handles. Use the feedback form in the shout box. Does anybody else have anything they want to add before I hit the play button here?
If you're a podcaster and you're looking for a home, contact Galaxy 15 Radio. Send us some content and we'll see what we can do about adding you into the list.